This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased to have with me today Dr. Troels Birchall Henningsen to tell us about his book titled Western Intervention and Informal Politics, Simulated State Building and Failed Reforms, published by Routledge in 2021. This book pretty much does exactly what it says, and examines the many dynamics, the political dynamics, the military dynamics between local regimes and Western powers who are involved in various ways to help us understand why things that Western powers want do or don't happen, how local states deal with Western pressures, and a lot more. So Troels, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast to tell us about your book.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Before we get into the book itself, though, would you mind introducing yourself a little bit and explaining why you decided to write this?
Yeah, I'm an associate professor at the Royal Danish Defence College with the Institute for Strategy and War Studies. And I've been teaching military strategy and war theory and also stability operation and counterinsurgency operation. And that was it was really through teaching that I got imperative to write this book, because one of the things that really stood out when I met our officers who have been to Iraq, Afghanistan, Mali, and so forth, it was constantly this frustration with the coin concepts or peace building concepts, and it was always like the If only we could get rid of corruption. If only we had a efficient local leader who would implement the reforms that we try to implement. So there's this constant frustration with the local authorities that seems to be part of their experience, no matter where they went. So one of the things that that really struck me is that it seems like that there must be something else at play that cannot really be reduced to this single person, for example, Karzai in Afghanistan, that he's corrupt, he's a drug addict, he's mentally ill, or something like that, and there must be something else at play. There must be something that really dictates how local politics work, and perhaps it really speaks to how our doctrines of counterinsurgency and peace building, and that they don't really take into account. So what I really was puzzled by, and really would like to explain, is why did the officers experience not fit doctrine and the theory that we presented them at the defense college? So how can we understand the political dimension of military interventions better, and what kind of politics is driving their behavior? That was really my driver for writing this book.
I think it's always really interesting when books develop out of teaching and out of kind of practical, hang on, there's something out in the world, but it doesn't seem to be reflected in our research and our theory. And it's very helpful to have those kinds of contributions. So brilliant to be able to talk about yours. As you mentioned a little bit there, you had students coming from experience in multiple places. And obviously, that practical element of real things happening is a key factor in this. So, can you briefly introduce us, now that you've explained a bit about the puzzle, the four case studies that you examine in the book and how you chose these to investigate?
Yes. I chose four case studies, and the case studies were chosen by by what degree these states were characterized by what I call informal politics or formal politics. And what I mean by this concept is that informal politics is, you know, mainly it's mainly characterized by high levels of clientelism, very little programmatic politics or ideologically driven politics. And formal politics is of course the other way around. So I chose two case studies with the high levels of informal politics, it was Mali from 2011 to 2022, and the Chad from 2005 to 2010. Both of these cases were characterized by an existential threat to the regime, which they survived, but they were existentially threatened. And then I chose a case with a mix of both formal and informal politics, namely Iraq from 2011 to 2018, and then Algeria as a case of more formal political settlement, which I studied from 1991 to 2000, so the late civil war in Algeria. And also the advantage of choosing these four cases is that you have two cases of very limited and indirect Western support, namely Algeria and Chad, and two cases of rather robust Western intervention, namely Iraq and Mali. So that was really what drove me in, just to explain why I really look at this element of informal politics. Is that the book asks the question, why do existentially threatened regimes derail Western demands for administrative and political reforms when they depend on Western assistance for survival? And one of the things that I look at is that informal politics is understood as a domestic factor that limits the ability of the regime to navigate. And one of the things that I was really puzzled by in the strategic security studies literature at that time was that they seemed mostly to look at ways that we could manipulate these local regimes, so that it was more a question of they were not really willing to undertake the reforms, but they were able to if they were pushed enough. For example, PA, principal agent theory, or alliance theory, both assume that. And when I look at existentially threatened regimes, the idea is to say, well, at this point, they have the same interest as the Western power. You must assume that they would want to survive, and their survival is at stake at this moment. So they should have the same interest, and yet they don't do it. So in this case, you have it would be plausible to argue that something must prevent them from doing that. So that was also why I chose to look at the case studies with high levels of informal politics.
That makes a lot of sense. And I think those cases, there's going to be a lot of people kind of going, oh, that's interesting. I hadn't thought of that instance in this way before. So if we put these things together of the puzzle you're investigating and the case studies that you're looking at, can you walk us through your method and theoretical framework that you use to analyze them?
Yes, absolutely. So So as you can see from the choice of four cases, it's a comparative case study to see if you can see that the level of informal politics has an effect on the way that the regime behaves. It's extremely difficult to study decision making in a situation of an existentially threatened regime, and it's especially difficult when you don't really have a paper trail. So in informal settings, for example, in Chad in 2006, 2008, there's not really anything that documents what took place and what kind of decision making process that was going on. So I wouldn't be possible for me to access that. So instead, I took an indirect approach where I looked at the level of informal politics, which I studied as a historical study, where I looked from, in these cases, the old post-colonial states, so from independence, typically in the early 60s, and then see what kind of elite took power. How important was clientelism and so forth to establish the level of informal politics. And then instead of looking at the decision-making process, I was looking at the actual observable behavior. It sounds very positivistic. It's not only about that. It's also simply to black box the decision-making process because it's so difficult to study. But then I expect three kinds of strategic behavior from regimes in informal setting. And the first one is that they will make use of Praetorian protection, which is a military strategy understood as one element is that you have reserved a few extremely loyal forces that are mainly preoccupied with protecting the regime. And then you have the larger regular forces who are typically they might be co-opted from former insurgents or militia. They might not really have the trust of the regime, so they are typically in various ways put in a difficult position that makes them inefficient, and so the military strategy becomes very convoluted because the most efficient units that you would really want to use, for example, for counterinsurgency, they are preserved for protecting the regime, and the untrusted underprivileged regular units, they are not really efficient for example, for counterinsurgency, but they can be used as a way of a political instrument to communicate and negotiate with the insurgents. So that was really one strategy, Praetorian protection, and the second element is the risk averse alignment, because if you don't really trust the state institutions, a lot of the elements of the security apparatus are not really trusted by the regime because they are co-opted. Then you depend on alliances. And what I argue is that what really guides this is an extreme risk averseness, which means that they will prefer domestic alliances over foreign alliances because they can better control it, and also they will hedge. So when they align with, for example, Western powers, they will hedge by making an alliance with, for example, a regional power and so forth. So, but what characterizes risk-averse alignment, and which is different from a formal political setting, is that sovereignty is really not an issue. So it's not really about protecting the power of the state or the monopoly and violence of the state. It's much more a fluent political negotiation of constant alignment and realignment. And then finally, if they depend on Western powers, if they need to make an alignment here, they will typically be forced to use what I call simulated state building, meaning that they are in a dilemma that they cannot really solve. So they depend on a lot of the military elite that are part of the security forces, or that they have made an alliance with. So they depend on them on the one hand, and on the other hand, they have Western demands for security sector reforms, for anti-corruption initiatives, for limiting the influence of militias on politics. And that really puts them. They cannot really make this. They cannot really handle both things at the same time. So what they do, I would argue, is that they simulate that they implement reforms while at the same time making sure that these militarized elites that they depend on, that they are still actually getting the benefits that they demand. So the theory is that if we have high elements of informal politics, we'll see these three kinds of strategies. And then, of course, when I chose the four case studies, I would imagine that we'll see variation in the kind of strategies that the regimes chose.
So, given this theoretical framework, I was even more fascinated that one of your case studies is Chad, because it's not necessarily used that often in comparison, well, at all, or with some of the kind of, if we're thinking of sort of very entrenched or very high level, not high level, very involved Western interventions, Chad doesn't necessarily come top of the list. And yet, given these dimensions you've just taken us through, it is a really interesting case study to examine. So how does it fit into the framework you've just described?
Well, I could just say perfect, because it is really a perfect case in the sense that it has a very high degree of informal politics, and Idriss Deby, who was the president at this time, he really made use of these three strategies to a very high extent. So in that sense, it is the perfect case. And as you say, I was also very fascinated by the history of Chad. So and you're right. We're not really thinking of it when we discuss contemporary Western interventions, but perhaps one of the things is that France had been present since the war with Libya, with the Operation EPV. So it has really been an ongoing operation, and so that might be why. But if I can just add a few more details to
sure.
give the listener an idea why it's such a fascinating concept. You can see that there's been a lot of attempts to rein in the army, professionalize it, and one of the things that happens constantly when there are insurgents is that it's constantly insurgents co-opted. So it's kind of an expectation that if you take up arms against the government, it's not so much driven by, normally at least, it's so much driven by ideology or anything like it. It's almost like you expect to be co-opted. It's more like a negotiation. So I think that is really interesting. And also another thing that is extremely interesting about this case is that it takes place at the same time as the Darfur crisis. And Darfur, I don't know if the right term is genocide or not. international law expert, but almost genocidal in scale at least. And one of the tribes that are really suffering from this is the Sagava tribe, which is the same tribe as the Idris Deby, the president of Chad, is from. So he can see that his own tribe is suffering in Darfur, and yet during this insurgency war from 2005 to 2010, he aligned not only with the Tama tribe, who is behind much of the violence in Darfur, but also Arab tribes who are also involved with the Janjaweed militia. So that says something about the level of pragmatism and the constant and how this risk averse alignment, how it works, and how pragmatic he needs to be. And even in 2010, we see that the insurgents, they constantly attack from Sudan into Chad. So he decides to realign with Sudan to avoid this risk. So this is really a controversial choice because, again, he's cooperating with the people behind the massacres in Darfur. But it's also a reflection that he doesn't really trust France at this point. The relationship between Chad and France becomes much much better in later years, as you're probably aware of. But at this point, he doesn't really trust them, because in 2008, the insurgents, they were almost in N'Djamena, the capital, and they stopped to discuss who would be the president when they top the current regime, who would be the president and so forth. So they're stopping to discuss how to distribute the spoils of this victory. And France, they are at this point undecided if they will support Idriss Déby or not. So, but when they see the insurgents stopping and they see all the conflicts in the insurgent alliance, they decide at the last moment to support Idriss Déby and the French airplanes, they aircraft, they attack the insurgent columns. The way that France acted, that's really that is I would argue at least is behind the realignment of Deby towards Sudan. So I think that's really interesting.
I think I'm glad you highlighted the word pragmatism. I think that is a really important feature of understanding how these decisions are made, and especially coming from the kind of Western literature that isn't necessarily thought of in terms of agency and pragmatism from the local leaders. So I think the case of Chad is a really helpful one in that sense. And I'd like to kind of stay on Chad sort of for my next question as well, because if we're thinking about French intervention in Africa, of course, the place that we often think of is Mali. And you examine that in the book, which I appreciated, to see sort of to what extent can we think of Chad and Mali in a lot of ways very similar, but not necessarily discussed together. So through the lens of your framework, what kinds of similarities can we see between the way decisions are made and the way French intervention is weighed up between these two countries?
Yeah, and I think also with the last comment you made, I think one of the commonalities is that the regimes, and I don't use a regime in a normative sense. So I use it both for democratic and non-democratic leaders. But one of the things is that this agency and pragmatism you speak of, that is you see that in both cases. You see a lot of ability to navigate this extremely difficult system of fluid alliances, but at the same time, as skilled as they are, they are also trapped within this informal political setting. They have to to navigate it that way, it's very difficult for them to transform this kind of political settings, this kind of formal and informal institutions. So they are both characterized by informal politics, and to some extent they both made the use of the strategies that I mentioned with the Praetorian protection, risk averse life, and simulated state building. For example, you can see that Touré, the president of Mali in 2012, before the coup, he took power in 1991, but he did it. But his power base was really the regiment he served in. So the paratrooper regiment, and this reliance on elite units that are really favorized and then engage in this kind of politics that's really that could have been found in Chad as well. But even though there are a lot of similarities, I also think that there are some really important differences. So whereas Chad, you see militarized politics, it's very much the way that the most dominant elite they negotiate and how they come to power. You see in Mali the militarization of the elite is mostly in the north. Because of the way that the regime in Bamako prioritized that they primarily spend money in the southern part of the country, the most populous part of the country. So it's really unprivileged, the north among the Tuareg and the Arab tribes. And at the same time, you see in the 90s and the early 2000s, you see a rise in smuggling and what we will call illegal economy. And the way they protect their smuggling routes is by the use of force and so we see a rise in the militias and how strong they are. So what is dominant in Chad is mostly found in the northern part of Mali. When the crisis spread, you see much more in the middle part of the country, but at the beginning it was mostly in the north. So it was not really an existential threat until very very late in 2012. Until then, it was just something that you could handle on a shoestring, so to speak, by just manipulating some of the militarized elites in the north. Make some alliances with a few of them, so they were more, you could say, pro-government. But at least you could manipulate them for your purposes. Also, I think that we see that when I look at the at Mali from 2012 to 2020 and when we get the MINUSMA and the Algeria peace agreement in 2015, it's much more subtle how Ibrahim Keita how he navigates this risk averse alignment, because no doubt he has a much closer relationship with the pro government militias, and even though that as part of the peace agreement that the Malian state should be neutral towards different militias and insurgency groups, but no doubt that he places he supports them in an indirect way and really tries to manipulate the peace agreement in a way that favor the pro-government militias, and that is really undermining the peace process to a point where it's breaking down actually in these months. but that's also different in from the Chadian case, where it was very obvious, the cooptation was very obvious that you became a minister for oil, for example, as a co-option. Then this is much more subtle, I think, in Mali.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Absolutely. And I think that those points of difference are incredibly important to pick out, especially given informal politics can kind of mean so many different things and be interpreted in different ways and different contexts. So if we move then to a different context, when we think of Western intervention and especially experiences on the ground by Westerners in the military, not necessarily matching up to theory, I think one of the places we tend to think of most immediately in the field is, of course, the case study of Iraq. So if we turn there, what does the combination of formal and informal politics look like in that instance? And what does that tell us about the theory?
Yeah, so Iraq was really an interesting interesting case study, and I should say that I look at the second intervention, not the 2003 intervention, but the 2014 intervention. And the reason I do that is because the first intervention is that means that the U.S. is really dominating everything in Iraq, and as long as the U.S. Occupation forces are there, there's no really existential threat to the regime. So I look at the later period, and I think it's extremely interesting because, and at some level, I think you could argue that Iraq is just as informal as Mali and Chad, in the sense that there are extreme level of corruption that is not really about only about getting richer, but also about paying off your political clients, securing your own position. So in that sense, and it's an oil-driven economy. So that is also really important because it's really rent-based, and it's perfect for clientelism. So in that sense, you could say that, well, perhaps it's more a case of informal politics. But the reason I say that it is a mix is that the formal institutions in Iraq are very to some extent aligned with the power distribution among the militarized elite. So, for example, the Kurdish Peshmerga forces, they are accepted within the system. They are paid off by income by the oil income, which is formalized in the constitution at 17%. So it's the way the constitution and the laws says that these should be distributed. It's also most of the time, at least, what takes place. And you see the same with Shia militia. On the one hand, you have the militias, and which is obviously supports an idea that is mostly about informal politics. But on the other hand, same militias, they are also political parties, political movements. So they are in the parliament, and they follow some programmatic ideas about what kind of Iraq should we have. Should we be more aligned with Iran? Should we be more defined by our Shia identity than being Iraqis and so forth? So there's some room for formal politics. They actually matter, I would argue. So we also see that in the kind of strategies that the that the government of al-Abadi, who comes to power in 2014, the kind of strategy he implements. So you could argue that you still have element of Praetorian protection in the sense that this counter-terrorism service that that the US put in place, they are extremely loyal to the president, and they are seen as to the prime minister, and they're seen as his force. But on the other hand, they are not present in Baghdad as a way of protecting the prime minister. They are at the front fighting the war. So so that's an element of it. And also you see during the war that the Iraqi army, it actually improves a bit. So it's not just about co-opted militias that are not very efficient. They are recruited, they are trained, and they actually improve at least a bit during the war with the Islamic State. And if we look at the risk averse alignment, there are elements, there are absolute elements of it. So what is the main accomplishment of al-Abadi is that he keeps together an extremely volatile alliance. So we have pro-Iranian militias, we have more, in the lack of a better word, nationalistic militias, which are loyal to al-Sistani, the religious leader in Iraq, and we have Kurdish Peshmerga militias, we have US troops, we have Iranian troops, we have US Air Force. So it's an extremely volatile alliance, and he managed to keep it together by making some rather difficult choices and difficult negotiations. So he, for example, keeps the pro-Iranian militias back. So it's the Iraqi army that makes the first attack with the U.S. support, and then the militias come in and occupy city afterwards. So that's kind of the way that he's able to keep his alliance together. And you also see it in the way that it uses simulated state building, is that as soon as the reforms is about the position of the pro-Iranian militias, it's extremely difficult for him to pass the law. Also because, as I said, there are also political parties, so they veto any legislation, and if legislation is passed, then they are able to undermine it when they try to implement it. So in some cases we see elements of simulated state building, and in other cases they are actually able to make reforms. That, for example, as I mentioned with the army. But one really interesting example of the way that al-Abadi tries to make legislation to rein in the pro-Iranian militias, and how it's undermined, is that the U.S. used put pressure on al-Abadi to make these reforms. For example, setting up a National Guard in 2014. That is, al-Abadi is not able to do that. But then we have the Popular Mobilization Front, which is a formal way of co-opting the militias into the security forces of Iraq. But what the pro-Iranian militias actually do is that they make sure that they are the ones who control the bodies, the highest bodies of the highest authorities of the PMF. So they make sure that they're still able to give enough money to have contacts with Iran, even though it's not allowed, and they have a lot of autonomy to act in the way they prefer. So when he tries to implement reforms that go against the interest of some of the most powerful militarized elites, we see the same kind of simulate a state building that we would expect in lesser formal context.
I think that's a useful one to think about, especially given, as you said, you focused on the 2014 onwards aspect, because there is room for a lot of different things to happen at the same time and understand kind of, wait, why did this bit work and not that one? And whose definition of work are we using, and kind of what decisions are being made by whom? I'd love to turn to your final case study of Algeria. In a lot of ways, I think there are some similarities with Iraq and some very useful contrasts to countries that we've discussed so far, especially I think Chad, because Algeria is sort of somewhat notorious for just how formal and fixed the politics are in a lot of ways. And yet that's not 100% of what's happening here. So can you walk us through how your framework of examining formal and informal politics works in Algeria?
Yeah. So you're absolutely right that at many levels, it is much more formalized. And we also see that the regime chooses very different strategies from the ones that I've described in the three other cases. So as you hint to it, it is formalized in the sense that since independence, the Front de Libération Nationale (FLN) really takes power and really dominates all elements of state and society. So the trade unions, the state-owned businesses, which are very important, the military, they're really recruited from the same segment of society. They see their interests as defined by the project that FLN is pursuing. So in that sense, it's highly formalized. Who gets what and why? It's highly formalized in Algeria, and also you see that the insurgent threat they are fighting is also highly ideologically motivated. It's not about, as we saw in chat, with this very very pragmatic politics and expectations of cooperation. This is real. This is about the Islamic insurgents. They want change, and they want to create an Islamic state, no doubt about it. And on the other hand, the whole state apparatus and all the supporting elements, they want to preserve the state the way it is. So it's much more formalized, and we see that in the way that the state reacts to the insurgents. And I should of course say this is an extremely bloody civil war with a lot of war crimes taking place on both sides of the conflict. So if I make it sound like very efficient approach by the state, it might be a little bit misleading, but because of course this was a nasty war. But when you look at the way that they structure the military and the strategies, it's very efficient in the sense that they are able to make a much more efficient counterinsurgency force within a relatively few years. They trust their regular units. They use their most loyal, most well-trained units. They use them very effectively against the insurgents, not for regime protection. So in that sense, and the military response, perhaps this is the only case. When you look at these four cases, it's the only case where it is actually the security apparatus that solved most of the security problem here. In all the other cases, it's about getting assistance from others or political negotiation that ends the conflict. But this is really a military victory. They fight the Islamic insurgents until they are there are very few left. And also, you can see that there are elements of risk-averse alignment that they for example, align with the local self-defense units. But you can discuss what kind of alignment it is, because the authority is very much in place. So they are controlled by the state. They're only allowed to operate in a very well-defined place, and so there's a lot of regulation of how they can act. So they are much more regulated and defined by the state, rather than being an ally in a normal sense. And also with the kind of economic and political reforms that are demanded by foreign powers or international organizations, you see that this is really the heyday of the structural adjustment reforms and then this liberal agenda of economic reforms. So when the IMF, they demand macroeconomic reforms, they actually implement them. And it really, in this case, it in fact improves their economy rather dramatically. So there's this willingness to actually implement reforms. That said, you also see some elements of informality. So, for example, with the demands for reforms, you see that what was also part of the demands for economic reforms is a high level of privatization, because this there's a lot of inefficient state-owned businesses, and there you see how important clientelism is within the state, within the trade unions, within the state-owned businesses. So it is privatized in that sense. They actually implement reform, but on the other hand, the ones who get to own the company, they are extremely loyal to the whole state project of the FLN, and so it's kept within the client network, so to speak, and you also see that in a lot of smaller cases where, for example, they liberalize foreign trade and who is allowed to do foreign trade, but when you see who get the licenses, it is very much the clients of the regime. So there's about a million members of the FLN party, and they receive a lot of privileges. So there are elements of informality definitely within Algeria, which I think also speak to a wider point, which I should have perhaps as mentioned earlier, is that no state is either entirely ruled by formal politics or entirely by informal politics. You always see a mix where there are elements of informality within the state.
Absolutely, and I think that's important, especially in cases like Algeria or Chad that kind of look very much one or the other. As we've been going through, we have been doing a bit of comparison between the case studies, but is there anything further you'd like to tell us about comparing the four of them all together?
Yeah, I think it is important to say that of course, when you do such a broad study with comparing four rather different cases, it obviously have it comes at a cost in the kind of details you can you're able to put into it. But I think that there's also some really interesting patterns that comes to light when you look at very diverse cases. And one of the things that I was surprised by, for example, which we haven't really talked about yet, is the way that in very different contexts, you see the Western intervening powers, they accept simulated state building. Not officially, of course, But in practice, you see very, very few consequences when they register that it is probably simulated state building taking place. So by looking at the and existentially threatened regimes, we also get an idea about the kind of dynamic there is when we have a crisis and Western powers really rely on a local regime to handle a threat. And I think that's very interesting, and that is also part of the conversation about political and administrative reforms, which of course is perhaps less we speak less of them today than we did a few years ago, but some of the ideas are still there. I mean, there's a lot of, for example, military assistance, which also is an idea about improving the efficiency of the state institutions and so forth. But the Western powers are really willing to put that aside during a time of crisis in order simply to avoid having to either take a political confrontation with the regime or perhaps even leaving. So the interest, the political interest of intervening and staying, they are so strong that they accept a lot of simulated vigilance in all four cases. And also, I think also what really stands out is that the strength, how strong informal political institutions are, the power of once it is in place, you really have to play by these. You have to play by these rules. I think that is also very, very important observation across the cases, because in the few pockets of informal politics within the Algerian case, there's really no way that the decision makers would be able to go against the interests of their client. So really studying not only the regime level, but also their relations with domestic elites and how these elites are able to influence the decisions of the regime. I think that is extremely interesting and a very and that is one of the advantages of looking at four rather diverse cases, that we see the same kind of importance or strength of informal politics.
I'm glad you added that in, because I do think that it's worth bringing into this conversation and seeing how these all go together, and speaks as well to, I think, kind of the next thing I'd like to, we've danced around a little bit and I'd like to make it explicit. What are the implications for your findings for Western interventions?
I think the book has become part of an increased skepticism against both Western military interventions and UN peace building initiatives and so forth. So I think in that sense it's part of it's part of the way we look at it at the moment. But I think there's still something that are perhaps more specific to this work. I think one of the main points is, of course, even existentially threatened regimes would have a strong interest in carrying out reforms. They are unable to do it. So that should really be a starting point. If they are unable to do it in a time of crisis, well, then perhaps we need to think of political and administrative reforms in another way. Either that it's something that should be implemented at a later point, or perhaps it should be demanded in a way that takes into consideration the power, the way the politics work, and the interest of the elite, so that it's much more carefully specified. I think that is also a point. But another point is that this is perhaps also a question there's also a danger in this conclusion that you might end up saying, well, perhaps you should simply just accept status quo. You should just work with whatever regime is in power, and you should accept that you're not really able to change anything. So what you actually believe is some of the reasons behind an insurgency or civil war, you don't really address them. So there's also a danger of complacency in this approach. I think it really raises the question of how can you be realistic about the kind of political environment the regime navigates in, but on the other hand, don't simply accept that the things cannot be changed at any point. So I really struggle with the question: what kind of policy recommendations should I make, or should I say that perhaps you should use informal politics in the sense that that you assume that the regime navigates by informal politics, and you do politics in a personal sense where you don't really believe in a wider reformed institutional cooperation, but you have a very close personal relation with a president or prime minister. And you can say that has somehow been the French approach, at least during the Cold War in their former colonies, to have this very close personal relation and manipulate elite politics. Who do we want to protect, and who do we want to, and where do we want to see a shift in regime, but not really. It's not really about changing politics, but it's about changing the person. But in a sense, that is really. But there are so many downsides by choosing this approach. You could argue that it's actually the Russian approach in Africa at the moment, that they cooperate with the decision makers, they protect them, they provide this Praetorian protection, but they don't really care about wider reforms or addressing grievances and so forth. So what I would argue is perhaps that we should follow what Jan Pospisil here argues, that perhaps we should have formalized political unsettlement, which is a way of saying that perhaps we should work, accept that we have this informal politics, but and keep some of the elements open and within the political institution and so forth, and then seek changes slowly, but constantly putting in pressure for different kind of for new ways of letting other elites express their grievances, or having ways of navigating these kind of political grievances.
Some very interesting ways this could be taken forward.
I'm sorry, just come again.
I think these are some really interesting ways this could be kind of taken forward and implications. Is there anything else you'd like to tell us on this piece?
I think when I recommend that you look very carefully at the kind of informal institutions that are in place and really limit what the local regime can do. I think if you look at the way that international politics is developing at the moment, I think we might actually see that we move in a different direction from a policy perspective. I think that if we have a more intense rivalry among the great powers, I think we will see a lot of the same dynamic as we saw during the Cold War, where you accept you simply accept you don't really put pressure on the local regime. So it was democratic communism back then, and now it's more about democracy versus authoritarianism. But it also means that you accept democracy at face value, and you accept perhaps that the simulated state building will take place. I would expect that to happen a lot. That as long as there are formalized election, for example, then we don't really mind if it's undermined by various ways, because at least nominally it is a democracy, and they are this state is aligned with the US, for example. So I think that is very dangerous, and that really goes against the kind of recommendations I would make. But I'm afraid that at the moment we're moving in a different direction, where we will tend to reduce to really simplify our understanding of local political dynamics, because they are seen as part of a wider power play at an international level.
I think that will be interesting to see, as you said, what direction this goes in terms of the content. But on a sort of similar point for my final question, I'm wondering what direction you might be going in. Now that this book is obviously out there, people can read it. Is there anything you're currently working on or looking to work on in the future that you'd like to preview for the audience?
Yeah, I mean, this might not be a surprise, but I'm looking into to proxy wars, which has really become a literature again. And I try to see it from the perspective of elite politics, because as I mentioned, there's a lot of hedging, a lot of constantly seeking to avoid risk. So what if we are in a situation where great powers actively try to manipulate local regimes, but if you see that from a regime perspective, how can they take advantages or navigate a situation of great power rivalry? So I think that kind of contribution to proxy war seen from below, so to speak, that could be really interesting, because it kind of changes the opportunities for local regimes, when during the war on terror they really had to navigate a Western pressure, because the West were present in so many places where there were very few other options. But if we come in a situation where there are at least one or perhaps more options, well, how do you navigate that, and what kind of regime behavior will we see there? I'm very interested in that question. I don't have any final answers at the moment, but I'm working on an article on that. And then also I'm also very interested in the relationship between war and institutions. We talked a lot about institutions and the power of institutions, but I'm really interested in trying to understand how war shape or influence institutions. So what's really is, when you have organized violence, it's about breaking down the institution of the enemy and imposing new ones, right? And that really means that a lot of groups and political collectives, they're in a position of extreme uncertainty, extreme fear. So how do they navigate this kind of situation and this whole volatility that comes with this uncertainty? I think that's an extremely interesting question. So, but that that's That's a more broad, perhaps theoretical project that I'm working on. But I think it's a very interesting element, the relationship between institutions and violence. Yeah.
Absolutely. No, thank you for previewing those for us. They are quite interesting. But while you go off and work on them, of course, listeners can read the book we've been discussing titled Western Intervention and Informal Politics, Simulated State Building and Failed Reforms. Trolls, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
You're welcome, Miranda.